Life in the Northern Plains is difficult. The weather is unforgiving, especially in the sub-zero winds of winter. And the sparse prairie landscape means that settlers here have always had their work and their survival cut out for them. Food, shelter, and fuel had to be taken from the ground or carried in. Nomadic indigenous tribes like the Dakota, Lakota, Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara leaned heavily on large animals like bison, who thrived in the grasslands to survive. Their homes and their tools were primarily made out of earth and animals. The American and European settlers who followed them into the prairies leaned more heavily on the soil after the fur trade and westward expansion had pushed bison and indigenous tribes to the brink of survival. The grasslands gave way to railroads, wheat fields, and grain elevators as waves of northeastern Yankees and German and Scandinavian immigrants moved in. The prairie now grew homesteads and small rural villages, and these settlers faced new challenges.
Prairie isolation was one of these challenges. The provisions of the Homestead Act that brought so many of these immigrants here required them to sign up for a life of rural solitude. Farmers had to live on their new farms, and that meant communities that had frequently lived together in rural European villages were now spread out for miles. People were left with their thoughts and the vast plains and an immense, uninterrupted sky. More than a few were haunted by a great, wide-open loneliness. This isolation and distance presented new challenges too, particularly when early settlers started developing families. Parents wondered how their children would become American citizens, better prepared to take part in life beyond the farm and the church. Where would they learn English? Where would they learn the basic arithmetic needed to thrive in a world of credit and interest rates? Where would they make friends and build community? For many, it was the country school, usually a small, rural building where a young teacher, usually a young woman, was tasked with raising Americans. And the challenges of this task, or at least some of those challenges, are immortalized in stories, many that you may have heard from great-grandparents about walking 5 miles to and from school, through the snow, uphill both ways. These memories are exaggerated, to be sure, but they begin to offer a glimpse into the hard lives of prairie settlers. In today's episode, we're digging into a different kind of prairie haunting, one in a rural schoolhouse near Richardton, North Dakota, where a particularly harsh winter was followed by one of the strangest occurrences in the state's history, the case of the Jitterbug Cole, a terrified teacher, and the bewitched Wild Plum Schoolhouse. I'm Davin Waite.
I'm Matt Hopper, and you're listening to Paranormal North.
The possibilities are unlimited.
In here with us.
Dim the lights if you wish.
You're listening to Paranormal North.
Welcome, and thanks for joining us once again for Paranormal North, presented by Forum Communications and the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County. Please support your local historians and journalists with a subscription or membership today. This podcast takes a look at some of the stranger stories that feature into our history in and around the Red River Valley, from Dakota prairies to the lakes and forests of Minnesota, Manitoba, and Ontario.
We each work in local news and history, and over the years, we've come across a lot of strange stories. We're particularly interested in ghosts, aliens, and monsters. So if you have a story you'd like to share, or an area legend you'd like us to look into, let us know. If it's truly bizarre, true crime, or even an odd story from the region, email us at paranormalnorthpodcast@gmail.com. We can't wait to hear from you.
Today we're turning back the clock to 1944, and this is a story that might easily be described as every teacher's worst nightmare. We'll be talking about a rural one-room schoolhouse in Richardton, North Dakota, where apparent poltergeist activity seemingly threatened the lives of 8 school children and their teacher. Stories of this paranormal attack made national headlines and even saw some involvement from the FBI, It's a case that would be referred to in papers as the saga of the Jitterbug Coal, and others would later call it the Wild Plum Schoolhouse Poltergeist.
And right there with Jitterbug, there's a good indicator of how far back we're going. So let's take a closer look at what was going on for a point of reference. Back in 1944, we had President Franklin Delano Roosevelt leading America through the Second World War, with the invasion of Normandy just over 2 months away. The United States is well over 2 years into its involvement in World War II, and Americans do their best to pull together, as they witness the progress of the war effort in newsreels played in theaters across the country. Speaking of movies, the 16th Academy Awards ceremony holds its first large public venue at the iconic Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, where Casablanca picks up the Best Picture Award.
He's looking at you, kid.
The war is shaping our world in many ways, and its effects can be felt in even the smallest American towns, like Richardson, North Dakota. Richardson has some pretty interesting origins of its own. Care to explain, Devin?
Richardson was established in 1881 by the Northern Pacific Railroad as a station named Spring Valley. The town itself was founded 2 years later, and life along the tracks meant big things for Richardson, including a robust economy, several stores, a hotel, a lumberyard, a brickyard, and a creamery. 10 years after its inception, German Russians and German Hungarians came in droves, and Richardson became a center for German and German missionary activity when the Benedictine Monastery of St. Mary's, now known as Assumption Abbey, was completed in 1908.
Fast forward to 1944, when our story takes place. Richardson has its own modern parish school called St. Mary's High School. The 8-classroom facility, equipped with a library, chapel, and assorted offices, is a far cry from the rural, one-room schoolhouse we'll be talking about. 20 miles south of Richardson sat our country school, named the Wild Plum Schoolhouse.
So you've read about country schools in North Dakota. What's life like, especially rural school life, in these days?
Sure. Well, I wanted to learn more about what the time period was like, and I found a book that really hit the nail on the head. It's called The Legacy of North Dakota's Country Schools, and it's edited by Warren Henke and Everett Albers. The one-room country schools were usually small box structures made out of wood and painted white, if they were painted at all. They were made portable, so if the population shifted, they could be moved a mile or two in a more centralized location. In 1944, there were roughly 4,500 of these structures across the state. Classrooms generally had an enrollment of 15 students, and their ages could range anywhere from 7 to 20 years old.
Now, 20 years old in a country school is a rare occurrence. At that point, you're almost as old as the teacher. Rural schools typically prepared students for high school in town, though many German Russian and German Hungarian students, like those we're talking about here, were pressured to stay home for work on the farm.
Back then, the teacher turnover rate was high too, and educators were hard worked and underpaid. One other thing I just wanted to mention because I thought it was amusing. In the book, there's a chapter devoted to what things a school inspector found when he was observing schoolhouses across North Dakota. It had to do with the bathroom situation. He wrote that outhouses, or closets, during the winter months were filthy and obscene in the extreme. He said it was nearly impossible to keep them clean or free from obscene words and pictures.
I wonder what he found.
Yeah, he didn't go into detail there, but let's get to the Wild Plum Schoolhouse. The one in charge of maintaining order on a day-to-day basis was a 22-year-old woman by the name of Mrs. Pauline Rebel. Pauline was the descendant of German Russians, Hungarians, and Romanians. Her maiden name was Obrigowicz, and she was newly married to another German Russian named Nick Rebel. In 1944, they would have had at least one infant child, and newspapers of the time described Pauline as pretty and blonde. Now, it's not out of the question that the married Mrs. Rebel would have been considered something like a phenomenon in the small town. That's because marriage bars were common in the United States at this time, meaning that if you were a married woman, most employers wouldn't hire you. Obviously, there was no economic justification for this, and it seems like the trend continued for so long only to uphold the long-standing societal belief of men as the breadwinners and women as the child-rearing housemakers. Discrimination against married female teachers in the U.S. wouldn't really be addressed until 1964, a good 20 years later, when the Civil Rights Act was passed. But that doesn't mean some areas weren't willing to make an earlier exception. In fact, marriage bars were often relaxed in rural areas, especially in schools like the Wild Plum Schoolhouse, because teachers were hard to come by. They would have been even more difficult to come by in 1944, as the United States was in the throes of World War II, and the continued effort at home meant many adjustments to daily life.
As the instructor in this one-room schoolhouse, Mrs. Rebel was in charge of 14 students, most of them being other German Russians and German Hungarians. At least five of her pupils were siblings, a fact that may play a part in the events to come. And while we don't know exactly when Mrs. Rebel began teaching at the schoolhouse, we do know when strange things started happening. In January of 1944, a note appeared pinned to the door of the school. The full contents of the note would never be revealed, but we do know that it was addressed to the young teacher and that it wasn't friendly. Perhaps Pauline brushed the note aside, but in this case, the mysterious letter writer would not be forgotten. Over the next few weeks, more notes would appear tacked to the schoolhouse door. They were crudely printed and obscene, and then the threats began. They soon escalated to the point that Mrs. Rebel had real reason for concern, with at least one letter instructing the teacher to leave or be shot.
This would have been a troubling threat by itself, but if Pauline was aware of other attacks against rural teachers that had happened years before, it's likely it could have been even more reason for concern. We know that in October 1923, the Turtle Lake community was shaken when one school teacher was assaulted in her own schoolhouse. The offender in the case was given 2 years in the state penitentiary for rape. Another disturbing case came out of Billings County in March 1935, when seven students witnessed the murder of their teacher, Miss Emily Hartle. Based on reports, a man named Harry McGill brought a gun into her classroom and began arguing with the teacher. He then hit her in the head with his rifle, fracturing her skull. After firing two shots into her body, he laid down beside her and took his own life in a murder-suicide in front of the entire classroom. I bring this case up to show that not only did violent attacks take place at other country schools, but in the murder-suicide case, authorities later learned that Miss Hartle's killer had sent threatening notes to her leading up to the event, writing that he would kill her for spurring his advances. Now, threatening notes are showing up for Mrs. Rebel, and feelings are starting to get tense within the confines of the schoolhouse. Do we have any idea who was writing these notes?
A possible author was suggested, but it didn't ease any concerns. On several occasions, the threatening notes outside the building were preceded by loud kicks or closed fists hammering on the door. Other times, the students would be startled by unnerving catcalls coming from outside the building. Alarmed, Mrs. Rebel and her classroom would rush to the door and windows to see who was responsible for the violent intrusion. It was during one of these disruptions that the classroom would reportedly catch a glimpse of the person responsible for the frequent harassment. Mrs. Rebel's student said that after hearing a loud bang on the door, they rushed to the window to see a man running away from the scene. They described him as approximately 6 feet tall, with the lower half of his face masked by a red bandana. But even more disturbing, he was seen running away with a gun in his hand. Newspaper reports don't make it clear if Mrs. Rebel herself saw the figure, or if it was just a secondhand description from her students.
Disturbed, yet undeterred by this series of ever-escalating, malicious events, Mrs. Rebel continued with her day-to-day responsibilities. However, in mid-March, a truly unexplainable event took place. Leading up to this point, North Dakota saw an extremely cold winter, with sub-zero temperatures around negative 43 degrees. March was cold, cloudy, and abnormally wet over a greater portion of the country, and it was Mrs. Rebel's duty to make sure the school's lamps were filled, the chimney stove was cleaned, and the scuttle of coal was topped to keep the fire going. On March 17, 1944, while Mrs. Rebel was instructing her students, a noise could be heard by the school's stove, where the scuttle sat. Now, if you've never seen one before, a scuttle is a large metal container with a sloping lid used to store coal. The noise was coming from inside the scuttle, and later reports would suggest it was the coal itself that was making the noise, as it apparently began moving around inside the bucket. It seemed as if the coal was alive. We don't know who saw it moving, but it was apparently loud enough to have the entire classroom turn their attention toward the bucket. Was the noise really coming from the scuttle? Was the coal moving around on its own? Did the students and teacher just imagine it? Whatever happened, it would be merely a precursor of things to come. About 1 week later, something more sinister would come from that same corner of the classroom. So, Davin, why don't you tell us how the Jitterbug Coal story, or the Wild Plum School poltergeist, made its presence known?
It's March 28th, 1944, a day no one in Richardton would soon forget. The day started like any other. Mrs. Rebel was giving an arithmetic exam to the 8 students there that day. As the lesson drew on, there was a disturbance. The schoolhouse had become somewhat accustomed to these interruptions, with the reported notes from the mystery man happening with some regularity. But this noise was coming from inside the classroom. More specifically, it was coming from inside the coal scuttle again. The students and Mrs. Rebel all turned their attention to the bucket. It appeared that the lignite coal inside the bucket was moving on its own. Before anyone could fully grasp what was happening, chunks of coal began hopping out of the scuttle. A later report described them like Mexican jumping beans. The action escalated. Without warning, chunks of coal were bouncing off the walls, knocking large holes in the plaster. A young student named Jack Steiner, or Steiner, was hit in the head with one chunk that left a bruise. Another hit the teacher. The frightened student screamed and hid under their desk for protection from this flying coal. The teacher looked on in horror. And the violence continued. The bucket of coal tipped over, and things went from bad to worse. Pieces of coal actually started to ignite. Terrified, the class watched in horror as smoke began to seep from the moldings around the windows. 9 of the window blinds started to smolder and then fell to the floor in a charred mess. Holes formed on a map tacked to the wall as fire burned through it. The fire spread to other parts of the room. Smoke poured from a bookcase. A copy of the Webster's Dictionary slid across Mrs. Rebel's desk, one report going so far as to say it exploded. We're not sure if these fires were coming from the coal or if it was some form of spontaneous combustion, but little fires continued to pop up. Books ignited. Smoke poured out of a mail-order catalog. One student later reported that a piece of paper she was holding ignited in her own hands. At some point in all of the chaos, Mrs. Rebel picked up one of the coal pieces. She would later say that it felt like it was trembling in her hand. The pandemonium eventually stopped. Following the chaotic whirlwind, Mrs. Rebel attempted to calm her frightened pupils, and soon after, she telephoned school officials for help.
After most of the smoke had cleared, the first person to arrive on the scene was rancher George Steiner. Mr. Steiner was the father of 5 of the school's students. Stepping into the tiny schoolhouse, he was shocked to find it in complete disarray. Holes were in the walls, the smell of smoke lingered in the air, and pieces of coal lay scattered about the room. As Mrs. Rebel explained what had happened, the rancher picked up several lumps of coal to investigate. He found that they were covered with some kind of white dust that looked and smelled like talcum powder. Whatever force had mysteriously moved the coal in the first place was was not entirely gone. Suddenly, without making any noise at all, one of the coal chunks leaped violently from Mr. Steiner's hand. Now, one important note, we don't know for sure if any other people saw this happen. Some reports say the school officials who showed up later witnessed the jumping coal phenomena. One article is even written in such a way to sound like multiple school officials experienced the coal trembling in their hands, but there aren't any other reports that seem to verify this. Despite his experience, Mr. Steiner would take a practical approach to the strange events, saying, "I'll admit it was uncanny to see lumps of coal leaping around the room, but it is my opinion that some kind of chemical was used to make it act that way."
Steiner didn't seem to think there was anything supernatural behind the bizarre events, but the students weren't so sure. As school officials tried to figure out what had damaged the classroom, they learned something else. At some point during the assault, that mysterious hooded man had returned. In all of the chaos, students reported that they saw the same hooded man from weeks before, running past one of the school's windows shortly after the pail of coal began its attack. They were convinced that their classroom had somehow been bewitched by the hooded man, who seemed to have it out for their young teacher. Now, whatever caused the classroom's destruction, everyone was in agreement that the incident had to be investigated. Suspecting arson, Stark County School Superintendent R.L. Swenson contacted State Fire Marshal Charles Schwartz to investigate. It was up to Schwartz to put the community at ease and assure them that these strange happenings were not from someone who had bewitched the Wild Plum Schoolhouse. Matt, do we know for sure what the community was thinking about this? Did they really suspect supernatural force?
It's interesting because we do have a few brief quotes from area farmers that suggests it was something that crossed their minds. One farmer said he thought the schoolhouse was bewitched, and another said it was the work of the devil. Although there are no names attributed to these quotes, so we can't really know for sure. The story did make national headlines, with some believing it blew up like it did because it coincided with the publication of a book titled Mr. Tompkins Explores the Atom by George Gamow. That book set forth the idea that such spontaneous phenomena is possible. The theory was first developed by physicist James Clerk Maxwell and became known as Maxwell's Demon. From my basic understanding, Maxwell's Demon is a thermodynamic theory that challenges the second law of thermodynamics. In science speak, normally molecules move erratically, but their increasing erratic behavior results in a more or less even distribution of energy, or heat, throughout an object. Maxwell's Demon challenges this law and suggests the possibility of erratic heated molecules being contained in one area of an object, thus creating an unbalance. Gamow pushes this theory further, saying that once in several billion years, a group of molecules might accidentally arrange themselves in an orderly movement that would upset the laws of thermodynamics. For example, all of the air molecules in a room could, theoretically, collect under a table and levitate it. In the case of the Wild Plum Schoolhouse, a group of molecules could fall into a pattern that would concentrate energy at a particular point and ignite lumps of coal. So was Maxwell's Demon behind this apparent act of spontaneous combustion, or was it the work of another demon altogether? That was up to investigators to find out.
The day after the event, State Fire Marshal Charles Schwartz began his investigation and closed the school until further notice. Schwartz entered the situation with the sole drive of solving the case from a financial standpoint, but it would prove to test his beliefs in many more significant ways. The case of the Jitterbug Coal, as it was being called, would turn out to be one of the most mysterious cases his department ever investigated. Schwartz's first order of business was to collect statements. He pieced together the events by interviewing school patrons, pupils, and the teacher, Mrs. Rebel. What he heard was a remarkable story, almost beyond belief, as they recounted the flying coal and the sporadic fires that followed. However, Schwartz was convinced the whole thing was a hoax, and he suspected the case was arson. He believed either the students, teacher, or all of them had to be responsible for the damage, and he was going to get to the bottom of the case by subjecting the entire classroom to a lie detector test. Now, the modern portable polygraph test was a relatively new device at this time. The original device had been invented decades earlier, but this version had become available and purchased by the FBI just 5 years earlier, in 1939. The frazzled Mrs. Rebel was the first to be tested, as the newspapers put it, to find out if she was all right. To the surprise of Fire Marshal Schwartz, she passed, proving to him that her story was true. Similar tests were given to her 8 pupils, who all told the same story as their teacher. The students passed as well. Investigators then went one step further. Families of the students were subpoenaed. In all, 32 people were questioned, and they all appeared to be telling the truth. Schwartz and others were floored. At that time, people put a lot of stock into the accuracy of the polygraph device. Schwartz said, "After we used the lie detector with negative results, we are of the opinion that witnesses were telling the truth. To put it mildly, we are puzzled." In their minds, the results didn't lie, meaning everything must have happened, from the hooded man to the fire to the witnesses who saw the trembling coal.
Now, Schwartz was joined in the investigation by Special Assistant Attorney General William James Austin. Despite the growing hysteria resulting from the lie detector tests, Austin felt that a plausible scientific explanation must be behind the case, saying, "We are continuing our investigation. We don't believe in bewitchings." Samples of the jitterbug coal were sent to several places for analysis, including the University of North Dakota, Dickinson State Teachers College, and South Dakota State College. Other samples, along with the charred dictionary and scuttle pail, were sent to the FBI. The coal was chemically processed to look for any substance that could have caused the spontaneous combustion, but all tests came up empty-handed, with nothing out of the ordinary being found. Despite the lab results, suggestions still remain that the coal must have been coated with some sort of chemical residue. Samuel G. Gordon, a curator of minerals at the Academy of Natural Sciences, said that the coal probably got mixed up with some fool's gold. Gordon suspected that the white powder that rancher George Steiner observed on the coal may have been the mineral melanterite, which forms when water causes fool's gold to decompose. Gordon pointed to the Black Hills region as an example, saying that whole beds of coal there would often become ignited due to a high content of fool's gold. Austin and Schwartz even consulted with a chemist who had his own theory. Through a series of tests, the chemist was able to combine 2 common household articles that produced a liquid that, when dried, left a residue that would burst into flame by spontaneous combustion. The residue could potentially cause explosions if submitted to heat or agitation. Austin didn't reveal what 2 liquids were used, but he did say such a liquid could have been sprayed on the curtains, books, maps, moldings, and coal, and it might possibly have produced the reactions reported by the teacher and pupils. More exhaustive tests must have proved both of the theories inconclusive or irrelevant, because they were never mentioned again.
Officials were baffled. Fire Marshal Schwartz said, "We have discarded the idea that it was arson. If anyone had sought to destroy the schoolhouse by fire, he would hardly have employed the use of this chemical when he could have done the job with kerosene." Special Assistant Attorney General Austin followed up by saying, "We are looking for either a crackpot arsonist with at least a smattering of chemical knowledge, or a hoaxer who so far has been singularly successful in his hoaxing. Frankly, at the present time, we don't know how he accomplished what he accomplished or why he has taken such action, but we haven't given up. We intend to get to the bottom of this mystery." Tests were run on the coal, the schoolhouse was examined again, but it yielded no new information. The story was making national headlines still, and fear was spreading among the community. All 14 of the enrolled students refused to return to the schoolhouse, and the parents quickly sided with them. George Steiner's brother John said, "I won't send my 2 little ones to school to be scared to death. I don't want things happening that make my children believe in ghosts and witchcraft." The teacher, Mrs. Rebel, didn't want to teach there anymore either. and with classes set to be dismissed in a few weeks, officials closed the school early. So with all the coal tests coming back inconclusive, all the witnesses passing the lie detector tests, and fear spreading throughout the community, were there any other theories people floated out there?
There definitely were, and they're my favorite kinds of theories, paranormal ones. One group came forward with their own theories, and this group was known as the Fortean Society. Formed in the United States back in 1931, the Fortean Society promoted the ideas of author Charles Fort, who could be considered the godfather of odd phenomena, since he wrote many books and articles on subjects ranging from the occult and supernatural to the paranormal. So the Jitterbug Coal incident out of Richardton, North Dakota, definitely caught this group's attention. Walter Dunkelberger was one Fortean, born and raised in North Dakota, and an active science fiction fan who wrote his own stories. He ended up writing an 18-page report on the Wild Plum School mystery that suggested the first fantastical theory, that poltergeists were behind the events. Poltergeists are thought to be a type of ghost that's responsible for physical disturbances, which would explain the flying rocks, for those who believed this theory. In fact, poltergeist activity is said to normally take place when adolescent children, specifically girls, are present, which there was no shortage of at the school. Radical studies on poltergeist activity continue to this day. One study suggested that the modifications to a child's brain during puberty could spark some type of teenage telekinesis. It even found that in rare cases, fluctuations in the brain's electron activity can create disturbances up to a few meters around the outside of the brain. So was it this unknown force that affected George Steiner's daughter, 15-year-old Isamarie Steiner, who said that her paper she was holding in her hand caught fire during the chaotic events? Another, even more incredible theory I found in my research was that some point to pixies or fairies as the culprits behind the destruction. Were there mischievous mythical beings behind the attack, too small for the naked eye to see? Unfortunately, in the face of all these fantastic theories, the outcome would prove to be pretty anticlimactic.
At this point, even Time magazine had reported on the strange events in this North Dakota schoolhouse, but none of the media coverage could offer a satisfying explanation of what had taken place. Finally, on the evening of April 17, 1944, four of the students confessed while being interrogated in front of their parents. Children were behind the flying coal and spontaneous fires. William Austin said, "One of our investigators asked one more question and the children broke down. One by one, they said they were tired of the mystery and wanted to get it cleaned up." So how were they able to pull off this series of horrific events that captivated the country's imagination? It was determined that somewhere between 4 to 6 of the students, possibly more, started the whole thing to have a little fun with their teacher. Luckily for the students, Mrs. Rebel was extremely nearsighted and, like them, shared a faith and a folklore full of spirits, including field ghosts and corn demons. In other words, this little rural schoolhouse had been primed for a supernatural experience. And apparently things started when one of the oldest children threw a piece of coal at Mrs. Rebel. Whether it was to protect her glasses or shoot her students a dirty look, Mrs. Rebel reacted by taking them off. When she did this, the other students screamed and joined in, throwing coal around the room. They must have had their underhanded throws down quite well, since Mrs. Rebel never saw where all of this flying coal was coming from. The day when things really got out of hand, students used sticks and rulers to jiggle the pail of coal and knock it over. They then pounded on their desks and stamped their feet, yelling to Mrs. Rebel that the mysterious hooded man had returned. She ran outside to investigate, which we didn't hear about until after the children's admission. When Mrs. Rebel went outside, the little hellions got to work, planting matches throughout the room. And one of the children started a fire in the books, bookcase, and window blinds before the teacher returned. Now, maybe it was easy to fool their nearsighted teacher, But how did the kids fool George Steiner when he showed up? Apparently, they just used the same tricks. Remember, Steiner had 5 children attending the school at this time, and as he questioned one of them, some of the other children stepped into another section of the room and threw coal at him. Another prodded the coal bucket with a long stick, causing it to stir. Was this all it took to get him so shaken up that he believed the coal was jumping out of his very hands? School officials reported on seeing the coal move as well, so were they tricked in the same way?
The children even admitted to fabricating the hooded madman. 2 of the oldest pupils, likely Steiner's 12 and 15-year-old daughters, said they wrote the threatening, sometimes obscene notes. While other students pounded on the floor and pointed to the window, the older girls tacked the notes to the door, behind the teacher's back. So that explains why the over 2 dozen notes were illegible and crudely printed. When she learned the truth, Mrs. Rebel was understandably upset and sad. She said, "I just can't believe that the children did this. If they did, why did I have to be used? I am too ashamed to talk." Her husband was quoted as saying, "My wife won't go back. She doesn't want anything more to do with that school." Investigators decided the students meant no harm in what they did, even though their escalating pranks involved death threats, arson, and significant damage to school property. So why did they decide to target their gullible teacher? Was it because she was a married woman who broke with tradition and was allowed to teach in the small community? Could the family of George Steiner, whose 2 daughters apparently penned the threatening notes, have had it out for the inexperienced teacher for one reason or another? It's certainly a possibility they could have concocted the whole thing, especially since 5 of the 8 students in the class were Steiner siblings. Was George Steiner himself in on the hoax, being the first on the scene and pretending the coal jumped out of his hands?
Of course, this was a stressful time in the United States, especially for German Americans who were forced again, only 25 years after World War I, to prove their allegiance to the United States. During World War I, German books were burned or thrown into the Missouri River. Miles away in South Dakota, the German language was even banned from schools. We also have clear evidence of a national trend of violence toward German immigrants. These suspicions of German allegiance softened during the Second World War, but allegiance was still a central concern. And the Fort Lincoln internment camp and the various German POW labor camps nearby illustrated the risks of cultural isolation, of appearing maybe too German, which was a hallmark of German-Russian and German-Hungarian life in North Dakota. Was the jitterbug coal another conflict of modernity or assimilation among Germans and German-Russians and German-Hungarians? We'll never know for sure what motivated the attack, or the full truth of the incident. At the end of the day, we have students who have been interrogated time and time again finally breaking down and admitting the truth. Could this have been a matter of officials so focused on closing their case that they forced students into a confession? We have a supposed answer written out in black and white, but I suspect we'll never really know why.
And that is the story of the Jitterbug Coal and the Wild Plum School Poltergeist. Thanks again for listening to today's story. If you're interested in learning more about North Dakota's country schools, I highly suggest checking out a book I used for a lot of historical research. It's called The Legacy of North Dakota's Country Schools by Everett Albers and Warren Henke. Also consider digging into North Dakota's past with a membership to Forum Communications. If you subscribe to Inform today, you can access forum archives and get access to unlimited content across more than 20 Midwest news sites. It's a great way to support local journalism.
You can also support local historical societies like the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, who direct the Yemkamp Center Museum, including Clay County's collections and archives. Stop in at the museum and consider a membership to support local history. If you'd like to learn more about North Dakota's ethnic history, particularly that of German Russians or German Hungarians, check out Plains Folk, North Dakota's Ethnic History, or reach out to the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU. Finally, if you have a story you'd like to share with us or something you'd like us to investigate, feel free to contact us at paranormalnorthpodcast@gmail.com.
That's right. And look out for more episodes involving the truly strange, deeply rooted in Minnesota, North Dakota, and beyond, coming soon. Until then, I'm Matt Hopper.
I'm Davin Wade.
Catch us next time on Paranormal North. Theme song and outro music created by Witch.